The House Transportation Committee will come to order. Welcome, everybody. We do have a couple people who are not going to be here today, and a couple who are coming in but a little bit late, so we're going to go ahead and get started because we have a number of people who want to talk to us today. And we're going to finish the invited testimony from Wednesday, and so I'm going to ask Brian Doherty, and I get your name, I mispronounce your name every time, so
my apologies.
Doherty. Chris Hagerbottom. Bummer. I look at that and think, okay. And Bob Stacy, if you all want to come up. And Brian, you can go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Doherty with the Miller Nash Law Firm, testifying today on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association. I was really working hard since Monday and then Wednesday and now today to find something brilliant to tell you after you've listened to 19 witnesses. I think it is a testimony to how many people have worked on this package, and I only wish our global warming and greenhouse gas bills had this much attention before you were looking at the policy decisions you're trying to make in that area. It really has had a lot of vetting, a lot of people here. We spent a lot of time together in the 18-month interim working on this package. And I'll just bring a couple of things I want to point out. I do believe this is a jobs bill. The Western States Petroleum Association does support a transportation package. We think it's important. We think there is a multimodal piece that's important as well as the highway portions. We think that you've got an ability to make jobs here, and that I think these type of dollars do transfer to jobs faster than most that you will see in state government. I think if you just looked at OTIA 1, 2, and 3 and try and analyze carefully how much jobs they created, you get an idea about what you might be getting out of this package. It may be too large. We have some concerns with this. I have also listened to Mr. Romaine's creative testimony about local option taxes. That's difficult, but I thought it was a creative way of trying to see if we can solve a problem. The final thing I'll bring up is gas tax. Our oil companies, unlike some folks, don't object to you taxing their product. And we think that's a public policy decision. We did not object to gas tax increases in Washington that totaled 14 cents over a two-year, three-year period. We do object to gas tax indexing. We think that is not the way to go, and there are a couple of bills like that. We believe that takes away your authority to oversee and approve what an agency needs, and I don't think you do that in many other ways in terms of an agency looking out with an ever-increasing budget number. But we do not oppose a gas tax increase that's in this bill. I know it's a difficult choice, and it carries some political risk, but that is not something we're opposing. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions. But thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer, and I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC supports HB 2120. We were honored to serve on the Transportation Governance Committee, the Transportation Vision Committee, and the Environmental Working Group that fed recommendations to the Vision Committee. We were really pleased to see during the entire process that all of the transportation stakeholders were genuinely interested in making recommendations that will move the state towards a more cost-effective and sustainable 21st century transportation system that supports both of our economy and our environment. I've attached at the end of my testimony a letter that we delivered a couple of weeks ago that's signed by six of the stakeholders who participated in that Vision Committee. So these are folks who are often seen as unlikely allies, and they include Thousand Friends of Oregon, AAA, Environment Oregon, Oregon Business Association, Oregon Environmental Council, Oregon Trucking Association, and the Port of Portland. So take a look at that letter if you haven't seen it already on your desk. Most of the Environmental Working Group's recommendations, as well as many of the recommendations from the Multimodal Working Group, were included in the Transportation Vision Committee's report to the governor and likewise in the Jobs and Transportation Act. I'm going to mention a few that I think are particularly important from the perspective of providing jobs, lowering transportation costs, building stronger, healthy communities, reducing global warming pollution, and otherwise protecting our environment. First, this issue of providing jobs and supporting our economy. We believe that a balanced transportation act will reduce layoffs and provide new jobs, particularly if we make significant investments in non-highway options. So there's a whole bunch of sections in the act that relate to doing that that I won't go into. But it's important to note that investments in public transportation projects often yield more jobs than investments in highway and bridge projects. There was a study done by the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, really related to the whole federal stimulus talks that have been happening at the federal level. And they found that the highest direct and indirect employment impacts of infrastructure investments are associated with investments in mass transit systems. They used an input-output analysis that found that an investment in mass transit results in 30% greater direct and indirect employment than an equivalent investment in roads and bridges. So what I'm trying to say here is that do be assured that investments in transit are also going to get us the kind of jobs that we need here during this difficult economy. I wanted to mention as well that if we want to optimize freight mobility, which is critical to our competitiveness and continued economic prosperity, we need to reduce car traffic at bottlenecks to help make trucks move more efficiently and more freely. So it really is important to make those transportation alternatives. I think if you looked at the Portland metro area and you took away all of the transit and bicycling and walking options, you would see that our highways and our arterials would be at a standstill. Secondly, lowering transportation costs is going to be an important part of this package. When we invest in transportation options, we reduce the burden of high gas prices, and gas prices are going to go up again. We can talk more to Brian about that. But and when we invest in transportation options, we help those who are the least fortunate among us, who may, in fact, no longer be able to make car payments and not even have a car to travel to get to work. Another small piece in the package that would help citizens save on transportation is to extend the sunset date of a tax credit that was approved by the 2003 legislature for an insurance company that might want to provide a pay-as-you-drive insurance option to customers. I won't go into the details here, but they're in the testimony. And I'd like to say that even though no insurance companies have come forward with a pure pay-as-you-drive product, the fact that we have that tax credit on the books has encouraged, for example, Progressive Insurance to have Oregon as one of the states where it's doing its My Rate program, which offers very significant discounts to drivers who drive less. The third major theme here, I think, is that we need to build stronger, healthier communities that have a lower carbon footprint and cleaner air. One piece of this Bob Stacey is going to talk about, so I'll skip over that. But a second piece is this part in Section 16 that launches the development of a least cost planning model. I think that folks talked a little bit about that on Monday. But basically, in order to make the most wise and cost-effective investments in our transportation system, we have to consider the full range of options for dealing with the problem and just take a much broader look than we've been doing so in the past. And then this will take a little while to develop this model for transportation, and so Section 14 also asks ODOT to work with stakeholders to look at the current criteria that are being used for the STIP and make sure that they're meeting the state's needs. There's a couple of other pieces. Section 19, Sections 25 and 26 are all related to electric vehicles and ways that we can get more of them on the roads. And then Section 16 is one piece that no one's mentioned yet, which is that would require ODOT and contractors to comply with the OTIA 3 environmental performance standards that help protect air and water quality. A big benefit of that approach is that contractors go through a day of environmental stewardship training before they start work. So field crews, foremen, and supervisors, they all learn why these standards are important for both the environment and their workers' health, and ultimately because they help contractors avoid potentially expensive mistakes, they can save contractors money and the state money over the long run. In conclusion, there was one piece that we really wanted to see in this package that didn't get in, recommendation of the Vision Committee, which was to authorize local transportation districts to levy an excise tax on commercial parking spaces, and this would be another way that local transportation districts, local transit agencies could raise money for their system, just authorize them to do that. And that could then be used for transit or other transportation investments that aren't eligible for the Highway Trust Fund. So I hope you'll consider looking at that as you move forward in developing this package. And we hope that the many hours of meetings of the transportation stakeholders to develop these recommendations that are now coming to you really result in your passing legislation that provides jobs, lowers transportation costs, and builds stronger, healthier communities. And I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Go ahead, Bob.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Stacey, Director of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for having us on these panels as well. I know we have a number of citizens who want to testify. I'll be as brief as I can be. The governor, when he started talking about a transportation funding package, which came to you as his proposed Jobs and Transportation Act, also talked about making this a sustainable package, and that drew our attention and our participation in the Vision Committee. In fact, the governor, during his address to the Legislative Assembly this session, talked about rebuilding our transportation infrastructure in a way that helps us win the fight against greenhouse gas pollution. We'll not just repair roads and bridges, he said. We'll invest in the most green, sustainable, multimodal, energy-efficient transportation system in the country. Now, I submit we're going to do that in small steps, not all at once. But there are a number of steps in this legislation that we were happy to participate in developing as a member of the Vision Committee. Chris Hagerbaum has talked about a number of them. I distributed a letter from a coalition of OEC, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and Environment Oregon. We call ourselves Transportation for Oregon's Future. And you know, there's about 25 co-signing organizations and businesses expressing support for the broad principles of finding a way to significantly expand the resources available to the state of Oregon to maintain and modernize our transportation network, with a clear understanding that most of that money is going to the roads and bridges that are the sole beneficiaries under our Constitution of the Highway Trust Fund. We want to be able to support that program and to ensure at the same time that we build that transportation network for the future while also achieving the greenhouse gas reduction goals that the Legislative Assembly adopted last session. So we made a number of suggestions about that, and Chris has gone through a number of those. I also bring greetings from Angus Duncan, another member of the Transportation Vision Committee, the chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission, who asked me to emphasize the importance of climate change in any discussion about transportation investment, because, he reminds us, in Oregon, 34% to 38% of the greenhouse gases that we produce come from transportation, and the bulk of that comes from our cars and light trucks, our pickups, our SUVs, our sedans. There are a number of strategies in the bill. I want to talk about just one of them for dealing with the greenhouse gas impacts of transportation. It's a program for funding transportation-related greenhouse gas reduction plans in Oregon's six largest communities: Portland, Salem, Eugene, Corvallis, Medford, Bend. This is not a pervasive program. It's not a new set of regulatory requirements that households or businesses would meet, but it's a long-range planning process that looks at the part of vehicle emissions that come from increases in driving. There are a number of suggestions in the bill for encouraging the use of cleaner cars and cleaner fuels. The third cause of transportation greenhouse gases is, of course, the amount we need to drive. Oregon is growing. It's going to grow again, let's put it that way. And most of the growth, if history is any guide, is going to locate in or near those six major metropolitan areas. We have strategies for economic development in other parts of the state. We hope they're successful. We know that success in other parts of the state will also lead to growth in the metropolitan areas, including Bend and Corvallis and Medford. So how can we accommodate that growth in those areas while also achieving reductions in the amount of greenhouse gases that come from transportation as we increase the amount of transportation? Land use planning and transportation planning provide some opportunities. If we can make it possible for more Oregonians to be able to walk for a half gallon of milk to a corner store on a main street or another neighborhood shopping center in their area, to walk to school, to walk to parks, to walk to other services, to take shorter driving trips on a local street system that has an interconnected network rather than major arterials that are hard to get on and hard to get off and only provide a few access points. Those kinds of choices enable Oregonians voluntarily to get around in different ways. The main opportunities for doing that are in the areas where we're going to grow, where we're going to build new neighborhoods, where we're going to be building new street systems, and where we want to make sure that the opportunity for walking, biking, and transit use, as well as short driving trips, are built into those new neighborhoods and to the redevelopment that occurs in those communities. So this planning process aims at those opportunities, creating more choices for Oregonians and how we get around so that 30 years from now, in new neighborhoods and in redevelopment areas, Oregonians will have more choices, and many of them will choose the short driving trip over the long one, the walk to the store rather than the drive to the store, a ride on a bike or a bus rather than a ride in a car. That's not regulation of households. It's not regulation of businesses. It's opportunity creation, and that's why we're so supportive of it and why we support its inclusion in this bill. Glad to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Panel. Okay. Representative Boone.
Hi, I have a couple of, thank you, Madam Chair, a couple of questions for Chris. How do your recommendations apply to, for example, my dairy community, most specifically mass transit and electric cars? And don't answer yet. I guess my message is I'd like to see the environmental community come up with some solutions that include all of Oregon, not just Portland and the cities, because, you know, if you will, the cities are really the problem here. And just offer a suggestion, like they do in London, they have the congestion tax, basically. It's a fee, put a sticker on your window, and if you don't have it in, you're driving in downtown London during those times, you get nailed big time. But people who come from the little towns outside need to go into town to visit somebody or do some business in town, have a different sticker, and they don't have to pay that unless they want to go that during that time, then they have to have that. But I listen to Bob and talk about some of the stuff that you'd like to see, and it sounds like the 50s would be great, you know. It's not real safe to do those things in some cases, and so I'd like to say in some of my small communities, my small towns, people do use their bikes. In Cannon Beach, there's a bus system that goes from the whole half mile of Cannon Beach north to south, and people can ride that system and then connect to others if they need to go to Astoria or Tillamook or even to Portland from Tillamook. But they do those things, and my constituents who are in these areas are very environmentally conscious of these things, and they don't want to be rewarded, if you will, by further taxing of things that they like, the parking thing and stuff. When they come to Portland, it's maybe once a month, if that. And we get that you guys have, and I can say this, I grew up in Portland and Seattle, so I have big city roots. We get that, but we, in the smaller areas, do a lot to keep our own community clean and carbon free, if you will, and running our buses on CNG. But I just wish it wouldn't just exacerbate this rural-urban thing, because it just seems like the environmental community gets tied into just about the urban areas, and it leaves the rural people out. And so I think that just creates the divide further. So if we could do that, is that possible?
Chair Beyer, Representative Boone. Well, our desire here is not to do something in this package that would make rural communities take on more than they need to. So this concept of having the metropolitan planning organizations work on better planning and land use to help citizens get around easier is really to get those fast-growing cities to take on most of that burden and not put a burden on rural areas. You're absolutely right that the small towns are some of the places where it's actually easiest to walk and get around and be safe getting around. And so people are already doing a good stuff, and often they don't have to travel as far for a lot of their daily trips. They have to travel unfortunately, often much further to get to the doctor or this or that. And so the concept is not to lock anybody out of the good things. I think all over the state we need better senior and disabled transit. We were just out talking with the folks at the Pendleton's editorial board, the East Oregonian's editorial board, and there's a real thirst there for some sort of transit option, or if not that, better carpooling options. And so I think people all over the state are really interested in this stuff, and honestly, we'd like to see as much happen everywhere.
Yeah, follow up. Yes. And I guess just to finalize that, just to make sure you understood where I was coming from, we really need the bridges and roads fixed because we drive them, and we don't have the opportunities for the mass transit. If anybody's ever interested in following along with me for a week, it'd have to be a week because that's the whole 500 to 700 miles I put on, there is no way I could make my schedule using the mass transit that is available to me. So it's imperative that we fix our our roads and bridges so that those of us who do have to use them for driving around outside the cities have the safest way to travel and the best and fastest way to get our freight through, too.
Couldn't agree more. I'm sorry. That's probably correct.
Well, Chair Beyer and Representative Boone and the committee, we are very supportive of this entire package of investments in roads and bridges, investments that are going to help freight move faster. And I just think an important piece to making freight move faster is to get those urban areas so that you can actually get through them. And that's good for the entire state's economy.
Thank you.
Representative Shaw.
Oh. Were you going to say something, Mr. Stacey?
Not without the permission of the chair.
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting. I grew up in a small town in Iowa, and we had corner markets all through this little town, and where kids and families literally would send their children to the store to get a gallon of milk. And the industry changed. Cars continue to grow in number in this country, and most of those stores are closed now. Not the automobile industry changed, the grocery industry changed, centralized, and we're continuing to further centralize with one company that will go unnamed here. But, you know, then you wind the clock forward, and I'm on Happy Valley City Council, where we actually were the first city in the state to, we carved out some parking spaces for energy-efficient hybrid cars. I don't know if you all knew that. And we got a bunch of press for that too. It wasn't my idea, but I voted for it. There's like 8 acres on Southeast 132nd King Road, right around the corner from my house. And a developer wanted to put a small commercial, like a small strip mall for a bit. He hated that word. And his argument was, look, do you really want to get in your car every day and drive clear down to Sunnyside Road to get a gallon of milk or to have a cup of coffee? Or, I didn't say this because I didn't want to ruin his chances, or maybe stop and have a cold beer on a hot summer afternoon. But I'll tell you what, and there was nothing in his plan that had anything like that, which was unfortunate. But it never happened. It never happened because, I'll tell you, people came out of the woodwork saying, no, we don't want any commercial. So it was right into what you were talking about, which you may be surprised. I actually agree with what you want to do there, because people should walk and ride their bike if they can get the opportunity to. I'm kind of concerned about some of the other things in this package that you may agree with that I don't. But on that, I think you're exactly right, and I just wanted to share that with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, thank you. I appreciate your coming and waiting until today to speak.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask Carl Rohde and Bob Russell to come up. And go ahead.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Carl Rohde, the Government Relations and Public Affairs Director for the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. I just wanted to comment today about the fact that we were delighted to be included by the governor on his visioning committee to develop the next great package for dealing with transportation in the state of Oregon. And I really felt personally, as someone who is both on the governance committee and on the vision committee, that we were considered an equal partner at the table, and that the efforts put forth by the Vision Committee were extremely collaborative. Although I must say there was one day when I looked across this table and saw the director of ODOT sitting between the truckers and the AAA, and I got a little bit scared for a minute, but we fixed that next time, and Bob Stacey and I sat on either side of Matt Garrett, and that seemed to change things a little bit.
That may scare some other people.
So the BTA is a 5,000-member organization serving cyclists and the interests of cycling throughout the state of Oregon. And while this doesn't compare to Craig Campbell's AAA with over 700,000, I just want to say that I carry in my wallet, as most bicyclists in the state of Oregon do, three items that are very similar. They are my Oregon driver's license, my gas card, and my AAA card. Because like most people that are in this state traveling around the state, we rely on automobiles and motorized transportation as much as most other folks. We just choose and wish that we had more of an opportunity to make a choice in transportation. And we strongly believe that this package goes a long ways towards doing that. In particular, the two items that I wanted to call out in the package was the transference of federal flexible funds into a multimodal account. The amount, I believe, is somewhere in the neighborhood of $44 million. We have, of course, for years dealt with the problem of the constitutional restriction on the use of gas tax dollars to be able to create a holistic transportation system, and we think being able to put this flexible federal money into a pot for multimodal transportation will go a long ways towards creating the kind of balance that this state desperately needs. The other is, and we appreciate the fact that the governor included in his package a 50% increase in the set-aside for bikes from the state highway program from the existing 1% that was established in the 70s from the bicycle bill to 1.5%. It doesn't sound like a lot. And yes, we've actually got another bill that puts it to 2%, and I understand that Senator Verger has submitted a bill that would put it to 3%, but boy, we'll take what we can get. The city of Portland has invested about 1.5% of its transportation budget over time to bicycle infrastructure, and that has resulted in a skyrocketing in the number of people that have that are bicycling in the city of Portland. And I think that that's a real wise investment of transportation dollars to be able to put just a small amount of money into something that creates a large return on investment. One return on investment, I'll give you an example. In advance of the stimulus funds, I was asked to come up with what are some possible projects we could do, and I thought, well, what would it cost us if we were to repave the Springwater Corridor, which is an old abandoned rail line that is currently paved in asphalt? What if we actually redid that as a 12-foot wide ribbon of concrete going from Boring to downtown Portland with lights every 50 feet, so you actually are creating like an interstate highway for bicycling. Doing that project would cost about $12.5 million. That's 21.5 miles for $12.5 million. Now I would like you to compare that to an item in the state transportation improvement program, which is extending the merge lane on I-205 south onto I-5 southbound 1/4 mile at $14 million. There is a definite least cost. When we look at the benefits in this package that says we're going to be doing least cost planning, we're strongly hopeful that in the process of looking at what are the least cost methods by which we might achieve better capacity on our transportation system, that included in that analysis we look at the opportunities to give people choice in transportation so that they may not have to use their automobile for all of their trips. So, I did want to say in closing that I really appreciated the work that Pat Wright and the governor's staff put into this. Although I personally did not avail myself of the free parking provided by Pat Wright's building, I do appreciate the fact that it facilitated other people's attendance at the meeting.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Association, and I, too, participated in the governor's effort during the interim. There were six committees total, and I was appointed to four of them. Some of them met as often as once a week, usually for at least 3 to 4 hours. For about 14 months, it was a pretty intense effort. Matter of fact, I think it's probably the most extensive transportation conversation that I have been involved in Oregon, which is certainly a credit to the governor and his staff and the staff of the Department of Transportation. I think they did an excellent job. I think it was extremely positive, and I think it has developed a work product that we can begin the legislative conversation and get something passed. One of the most pleasant surprises, I think, of the whole thing is the relationship that Craig Campbell and I developed with the environmental community. And I think it's resulted in some real positive output. What you have in front of you is a list of items that both the transportation folks and the environmental folks want to see in the transportation funding package. And I'll go through them very briefly. I want a dedicated fund for transit and other alternative modes. As you've heard already, that we do have a dedicated fund for highways, and this would be a complement to that. Develop a least cost planning system for transportation. Least cost planning is a sort of a concept that comes out of the utility regulatory environment. And basically what it means is you have an identified need, or in this case an identified transportation need, and you look at the alternatives for meeting that need, and you pick the one that costs the least. And doing that, you can also take into consideration a number of policy things, as they do in the electrical or in the utility industry. In transportation, we call it the externalities. It would be the cost of crashes. It would be noise and environmental costs as well, including carbon output. That can all be included in that planning process in assessing the cost to come up with the project that meets the need at the least cost. Sort of assumed in this is that there would be a reduction in automobile VMT as we're going forward. Sort of the complementary piece to that is that we would develop a new system of cost allocation. About 6 years ago, we sort of did a trial run, and we called it the efficient fee method of cost allocation. Today, the way we do cost allocation is we don't actually do costs, we do expenditures. So we know what ODOT is going to, in the cities and counties, are going to expend in the future, and we allocate that between cars and trucks and then the various weight classes of trucks. And we determine what each's fair share is, and that's how we set the taxes for each side. With the efficient fee, you're actually looking at costs, including replacement costs, so that you are considering everything instead of just what you're going to expend. For example, there is a cost of congestion. And if you are in a congested area during that period of time, then you are actually putting more demand on the system and you should pay more. It's that whole concept of the fully allocated cost instead of doing the expenditures. That, with least cost planning, is a huge shift in the way we've approached transportation, and will be much better for us and for the environment going forward. Of course, we'd like to eliminate highway bottlenecks. That's a very key part of this. Vehicles that are sitting in congestion put out more emissions. If we can keep traffic flowing smoothly, that reduces emissions, and that's really good for the environment. Last session, those of you that were here, you passed the clean diesel bill. Of course, we'd like to continue that. It provides retrofits for not only trucks, but for all diesel engines in the state. And we'd like to increase the BETSI tax credits from 35% to 50% for those things that reduce the consumption of diesel fuel and gasoline as well. The best way that we can actually reduce emissions is to conserve on the fuel that we burn, and the BETSI program is a very successful and cost-effective way of doing that. So these are the major environmental initiatives that we would like to see included in the package. You've heard of some other things that are in, some that are in and some that aren't in. Most of those, I think, would be are good ideas and we ought to go forward with. When the governor was before the joint committee and talked about the package, he did say that this is sort of the beginning of the conversation with the legislature, and we've sort of started that this week, which we're glad to see we're moving forward. And clearly, for my organization, we are very supportive of a transportation funding package. I want everybody to be very clear. However, the world has changed a bit for us in the last several months, and we feel ourselves sort of caught between two harsh realities. On the one hand, and you've heard prior witnesses say that the volume of freight is going to double in the next 20 years. Actually, the report that I recall said from 2005 until 2025, it's going to double. So we're already well down that 20-year pike. When we build highway projects, on average, for a state-funded project, it takes 8 years from the time that we have the idea until we finish the project. If it is a federal aid project, it takes about 13 years. So it takes a really long time to build the improvements to our system, and during that period of time, the volume of freight is going to double. Can you imagine double the amount of trucks on today's highways without any additional expansion? I mean, it's just sort of mind-boggling from our perspective, the congestion that would cause. So that plus the fact that we think that the federal government is going to pass a significant tax increase in 2010 or 2011. Every 6 years, the federal government reauthorizes their transportation programs, and at that time, they look at taxes. The trucking industry is already on record as saying that we would support a 44-cent a gallon increase in the federal diesel tax, which is a very large increase. We think that there is going to be a large increase at the federal level. If we don't do something this session, we think that politically it's going to be difficult to do something in 2011 because we're just going to have passed this huge federal tax increase. So we think that clearly that this session is that window of opportunity. And matter of fact, we think we're probably a little late based on the length of time that it takes to build highway projects. We got to get going and take care of some of the problems we have on our highways. So that's the one harsh reality. The other harsh reality is sort of the economy that we find ourselves in. This is uncharted waters for us. In January of this year, these are national numbers, there were 24,900 folks in the trucking industry that lost their jobs. From December of 07 through January of 09, there's a 14-month period, we lost 110,000 jobs. So what I'm saying is we lost almost 25% of those jobs in 1 month, and that was January. I have not yet seen the figures for February, but I think they're going to be equally as bad. One of the barometers that I sort of use locally to see where we...
Right. So if you have a cell phone on, please turn it off.
Thank you. Is to look at the want ads in the Sunday paper. A year ago, in the Oregonian, the want ads for truck drivers were about three-quarters of a page. I mean, there were hundreds of them. I don't know how people got through them. Last Sunday, there were three ads. That's it. Some segments of my industry are down 25%. Those that are associated with the building industry, loggers, flatbeds, hauling lumber, that kind of stuff, they're off almost 40%. We don't quite know where the bottom is here, but you know what's of more concern, quite frankly, than the impact on our industry is we're hauling 72% of the tons of freight in the state. We are what makes Oregon's economy go. If the tax increase is too big, it's going to have a ripple effect throughout the whole economy. And it could stall or prolong this awful recession. So that's the other harsh reality that we find ourselves in today. We have to find the balance between those two as we work together and move forward on a transportation funding package. There's just a couple other things that I would like to mention. You heard one witness talk about bonding last time we met. Bonding is a very sort of confusing thing in this building because of our finance system is fairly complex and you've got different funds and all that kind of stuff. Bonding it also has its place. For example, I think it would be totally inappropriate to issue bonds for maintenance of highways. That's not what it's for. If you issue bonds for capital construction, like we did with OTIA 3 for bridges that last 75 years, that makes some sense. The way it sort of works in my mind is when you go buy a house, you take out a mortgage, which is sort of like bonding, and that works. Part of the reason that we're in this crisis is that some folks took out second mortgages to pay for painting their house and paying for cutting the grass. That's not appropriate. And that's part of the reason that we got ourselves into this fix. So where we're doing capital construction that has long-term benefits, I think bonding is a very appropriate thing. Another thing from the standpoint of stimulating the economy, you know, the federal government is in a totally different position than we are. They can print money. So they do a stimulus bill, and they just create more money, and off we go, and that increases the supply of money, which in fact stimulates the economy. If you were to tax one group and then spend the money on another group, all you're really doing is transferring money from one set of folks to another. So if you collect a gas tax from these folks and then you pay contractors over here, you're not really increasing the supply of money, you're just moving it from one sector to the other. However, if you employ bonding, that is the only way that you can, in fact, expand the supply of money, albeit for a short period of time, and have a true stimulus effect on the economy. The other sort of issue is how much headroom do we have to actually issue bonds? Because you folks are hearing about it in terms of general obligation bonds under the general fund. You're hearing about it in lottery bonds. It's different depending on the funds. If you pass new tax revenues that's dedicated to retiring the bonds, that increases the amount of headroom that you have to issue bonds. So when we talk about lottery bonds, you don't increase the lottery, per se, unless people pull more handles, but you can't increase it like you can a tax. So there is a certain amount of bonding that is prudent with the lottery fund. Here we're talking about substantially increasing revenues, which gives you more of an ability to bond. So I think that's an important point. A couple of things that I think are just really critical as we go forward. I think this package needs to definitely be multimodal, not only on the passenger side with transit and those kinds of things, but also on the freight side. The continuation of Connect Oregon or Connect Oregon 3 is part of this package, and we think that's very positive. It's going to take all modes working together, whether it be transporting people or freight, if we're going to meet the demands for transportation services in the future. There's also sort of this issue of accountability. And 2 years ago, about the same time of year, I was before this committee, and we were talking about transportation funding. And one of the things that I said that's very important for my industry is that we know what we're buying before we write the check. We need to have a list of projects, and then we need to follow that list to make sure that those things get built. This is not new stuff. This is the way the state of Washington has done their last two funding packages. They have a wonderful website that they update weekly where you can go look at the list of projects and see the status in your county or your city or however, whatever. to see how things are progressing, and that list was developed before they passed the package. I think that is a very critical element to our success here. The other thing is we're talking about job stimulation here without question, and we think that that is very important. But we're also talking about a transportation package. We can't lose sight of the transportation needs that we're trying to address while we're also trying to create jobs. I think we can accomplish both, but we need to be sure that we are not compromising one for the other, at least from our perspective. And I think that I'm going to thank you very much for your attention on a Friday afternoon and stop there and answer any questions that you might have.
So, Representative Schaffler, and we have a list of people, so...
Only to say, Springwater Corridor bisects my district, and my wife and daughter have used it, and it's very pleasant. But I look forward to that entire right-of-way out to Boring being one beautiful strip of concrete someday.
Representative Bailey, please.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Rhodes, just out of curiosity, off the top of your head, you don't happen to know what percent of commuters in the Portland area are cyclists?
Chair Beyer, Representative Bailey, currently citywide it's at 6%, but there are some districts, southeast Portland and parts of northeast Portland, that are 28%. We're actually seeing a daily crossing of the Willamette River of over 14,000 cyclists a day.
And off the top of your head, do you happen to know, proportionately, ballpark, what percent of road funds in the Portland area are spent on infrastructure for cyclists?
Chair Beyer, Representative Bailey, it's currently at about 1.5%.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. I have Ken Armstrong, and is Annette Price wanting to come up? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong representing the Oregon Public Ports Association. I hope I won't disappoint the committee if I offer some of the briefest comments on this bill.
Probably
so far.
Not.
I'm
no.
sure not. Oregon's public ports, there are 23 ports in the state of Oregon, and they range all the way from one of the state's largest economic engines, the Port of Portland, to among the smallest, those on the Oregon coast. And without exception, transportation funding is at the very top of the agenda for my association. So we're very pleased to be able to be here in support of House Bill 2120. And we also have been very active, as have so many others that have testified before me, in the development of this throughout the interim on the committees developing the package. We think what has come up here is a tremendous opportunity and is frankly very exciting in the midst of some very discouraging times. I think one observation, I guess, is that we were very active in the development of Connect Oregon 1, in the development of Connect Oregon 2, and this seems to be the logical next step with that. Obviously, this is far beyond either of those Connect programs, and we've been there for those two. We're here for this one as well, and we're looking forward to playing whatever role that we can with the governor, with the agency, with the legislature in moving this package forward. Any assistance that we can provide, we'll be happy to do, and I'll wrap up with that.
Thank you. Any questions? Well, you must have been very succinct. So.
Happy to.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay, and now we're going to go to the public testimony, and we have a number of people here signed up, so we're going to kind of try to keep time on these to keep everybody moving and give everybody a chance. And with that, I'm going to ask Jeff Bernards, okay, and Janet Lothar. And you want to come up and we can get you in there. And Philip Selingus? Sellinger? Okay, sorry. And... And go ahead while we get the rest of them situated,
okay,
so we can get moving.
Chair Baer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bernard. I'm a constituent from Portland. I drove up today because the gas tax is a big issue to me. I'm here to ask you to raise the gas tax at least 22 cents, like the state of Washington. ODOT claims that the tax needs to be raised over 40 cents in order to repair or replace our current infrastructure. Fighting over whether it should be 2 cents or 6 cents isn't even the issue. Trying now to establish an alternative to the gas tax will waste precious time and resources. To buy tracking devices and gas pump readers will cost millions, none of which will go to fix our ailing roads. The gas tax is fair, established, and a proven source of revenue that works. The more you use, the more you pay. The reason the gas tax hasn't kept up with infrastructure needs is the legislature's failure to raise it to a level that maintains our infrastructure. Raising the gas tax solves many financial and environmental problems all at once. People will drive less, cutting down on CO2. When gas was $4, the roads, a lot of people realized they could walk to the store or use mass transit. Smaller fuel-efficient cars will be in demand, lessening our dependence on foreign oil. Alternatives to car are more appealing: bicycling, walking, carpooling, transit. State police can be hired 24/7 to patrol our highways, maintaining road safety for everyone. The gas tax can act as a carbon tax, thus helping tackle climate change. Using other revenues to support highway costs only hides the true cost of driving and hurts other essential state programs. This will encourage also people to buy products that are made locally instead of shipping and trucking long distances, which is subsidized by the taxpayer if we don't pay a gas tax. Europe has an approximate $4 a gallon gas tax. The first things you notice when you're visiting is small cars, good roads, and great mass transit, yet their economy seems to maintain a large middle class. I drive a large truck for my business with poor gas mileage, but I still think it's the fairest way to pay for the roads that we all use. 2, raising money is important, but saving money is important too, I think. Banning studded tires in favor of studless tires would really preserve our roads. Anyone who lives west of the Cascades, if you haven't driven on the roads and seen the ruts and the pits and everything, they're just, it's going to cost hundreds. I drove down from Portland. It is a mess all the way down here, and maybe 5% of the people use studded tires. 95%, the rest of us are paying for it. I don't think they're, I mean, we need to save some money too. Anyway, ODOT has begged for years to have studded tires banned because they can't keep up with the repair bill. And if we're out of money, I think that the luxury of studded tires has kind of run its course. So I'm used to speaking at the city where you get 2 minutes, so I'm really in a rush here. So anyway, Oregon's recognition as an environmental leader needs updating. We've ridden the bottle bill inventiveness a little too long. It's time for something new. Please consider raising the gas tax for the long-term benefit of Oregon and not the short-sightedness of saving a few cents now and not preparing ourselves for a future that's short of oil. You tax cigarettes to curb use, please tax gasoline to help achieve the same results. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and finish the panel, and if we have questions. Janet,
go ahead. I'm mostly in support of mass transit and public transportation. I graduated from high school.
You want to identify yourself for the record?
Oh,
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Chairman.
That's okay.
My name is Janet Lowther. I live here in the city of Salem. I grew up out here in the Olina-Moala area, and I graduated from high school 40 years ago, and at that time we were talking about mass transportation and landscaping and doing things to keep things in the community. And I applaud all of you for all of your work, and all these people that are testifying, I think, is just really exciting. I support mass transit because it's my only way to get anywhere. My wheelchair just doesn't fit in people's cars. People are always saying, well, can't I take you over here, or can't I give you a ride? Well, not unless you have a van accessible with a wheelchair lift. And at the moment, I do not own a private vehicle. Someday, maybe I'd like to, but the cost is kind of prohibitive to buy a wheelchair-accessible vehicle. So I am very dependent on mass transit, and I see a lot of other people out there riding on mass transit because I ride a bus almost every day. So that's my support of mass transit.
Thank you. All right, Philip. Well.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Baer and elected leaders. My name is Phil Sellinger. I'm the I'm a Portland resident speaking as the president of the board of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. We're a nonprofit organization working to improve conditions for walking in the Portland region. And thank you for this opportunity to speak. The livability of our communities is increasingly defined by their walkability. Too often roads are built with little regard for the pedestrian. As a result, citizens are forced to drive to that corner store we talked about. But also as a result, significant investments in public transportation are underutilized. Sidewalk gaps, a lack of crosswalks, unsafe conditions, all perpetuate our auto-oriented society. Citizens need transportation options. Even modest investments in bike and pedestrian systems go a long way to improving mobility. These projects are also suited to smaller contractors who cannot compete for the larger road projects. Community vitality and health is improved when walking is a safe and realistic option for meeting daily transportation needs. The Willamette Pedestrian Coalition supports House Bill 2120 and asks that pedestrian infrastructure needs in communities throughout the state be treated as a priority, not an afterthought. To take this important step, to reduce automobile dependence, reduce climate impact, improve community livability, and improve the health of Oregon citizens. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Committee, questions at all? Representative Cole.
If I could just briefly, it's Janet, isn't it? Thank you. We've actually had on a couple different occasions folks in here talking about transit and the fact that failure of Salem to pass a bond measure has meant that we've discontinued service here.
On Saturdays.
On Saturdays. And I think it's very beneficial for you to talk to us about how transit has benefited you. I think it would also be equally beneficial if you could talk about how services being cut as drastically as they've been in Salem has impacted your life. I think that would be very helpful for us.
Well, I don't go anywhere on Saturdays unless I just take my wheelchair and go. And we have no Sunday bus service in Salem either. I don't think there's ever been a Sunday bus service. I'm looking for a sport from back here. And I like to go to the Salem Concert Band. They're four times a year concert, but I take my chair clear downtown and come clear back. And I live by Lancaster Mall. But the cuts on Saturday, I used to go downtown shopping and doing things on Saturday, but I just mostly stay in my apartment on Saturday now. And I know there's people that want to get to jobs, and transportation just isn't there, so they either have to use taxi or walk. And the sidewalks in this town are not real great.
Thank you.
So that's, I'm excited about the walking and the biking, because wheelchairs can do that same pathways as bikes and walking.
Thanks.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you guys for coming and testifying today. We really appreciate it. Andrea Meyer, John Charles, and Neil Feldman. Did we lose John?
I'm missing someone.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here only briefly to talk about a very small part of this bill. Many of the issues that I think you've been hearing about are complicated and difficult, and I'm thankful that they are not ACLU issues. But there are a few, and I want to issue spot for you some concerns that we have regarding to probably not your, any of your surprise, the issues around the mileage tax creation with sections 5, 6, 7, and 8 in terms of the pilot programs on congestion tracking, as well as just the overall issue around the possibility of using mileage tracking issues around taxation around the miles that someone drives. Section 5 discusses the Oregon Transportation Commission establishing a pilot program to implement congestion pricing in communities within the state. The concern we have with that, as well as just that broad area, is you need to know where the person is at the time or some locations it might be that somehow they can simply track if they're on I-5, 205 on certain freeways. But nevertheless, there has to be some ability and need to know when they were there and where they were to get to the congestion. And, you know, it also brings us to the larger issue we have with this possible pilot and the previous pilot program and what's going on in this area. You know, there's been assurances that there's no tracking going on and that they won't hit that switch or they can't turn on that switch. And we're concerned about that. We're a little skeptical of that. And I know this program's always been talked about to be linked with the federal government and other states. And we would be concerned, and we would want to raise this for you to be aware, that even if Oregon said, well, we aren't going to turn on that switch, we would never hit that switch. How do we prevent the federal government or others from doing that? But that also brings us to a concern about, and I want to back up and just briefly say that in Section 7, there's some good recognition of privacy issues. In Section 7, one of the issues is to protect the privacy of the motoring public, and I'm pleased to see that language in there. Section 8 then talks about how to develop these pilot programs and the kind of technology and methods and things you need to have. Identifying vehicles, collecting and reporting miles traveled, receiving payment, and so on. So I want to bring up not a privacy issue, but a due process issue for you. We have significant concerns of how we can run some of these kinds of programs when a person will be charged the tax at the time they go to the gas pump. Because what happens when there's an error, when there's a problem or a question? What happens when someone is believed to travel 1,000 miles on Oregon roadways, but really they believe they only traveled 100? Are they to pay the tax at the time? Is there a process for them to appeal? What systems are available? You know, I don't know about you. I had one time where I checked I got my gas bill, and it seemed extraordinarily out of whack. And I could call a gas company, and I went outside and looked at the thing that they read, and they had me read it to them, and they said, indeed, they had made an error. And they corrected the amount I owed at the time, and it was not out of pocket anything. And so that process was available to me. I'm particularly concerned about folks who are low income, who are going to the gas station and saying, I've got $5, and so I'm going to get $5 worth of gas. But they won't be able to know that if they owe miles on previous miles that they've driven. So there's other situations where if a person not trying to dodge this does a lot of miles in Oregon, but they fill up in Vancouver because they work there or they're visiting someone there, and they fill up in Vancouver regularly. And all of a sudden, they finally fill up in Portland, and they've got all those Oregon miles, and they are facing one big bill at that moment. How do they handle that? What process is available? So I think you get the gist of the issues I'm raising. I just haven't heard them discussed before when we're talking about this. I think people look at us and, sure, ACLU does have privacy concerns, but we also have due process. And the rub with that is, unless you keep track of the miles and where a person was, how do they go in and appeal the fact that they did not do those miles? So, today is probably not the day to get into the privacy issue, but I hope today and soon is the issue to get into the due process concerns and make sure that if all that we're doing with this bill is to move forward with a pilot project, that there be due process written into this legislation to ensure how is it going to be paid for, how are people going to be able to appeal, and there isn't privacy language in that those factors in Section 8. There is a public acceptance and a cost for implementing this, but I would urge that there also be some reflection of really an understanding of the privacy protections, especially if we're going to link with the federal government. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll go ahead through the panel. And,
okay.
Thank you, Committee, Chair. We are having an informational hearing on the VMP project on Monday. So if there are questions about it, there'll be plenty of opportunities there also to ask.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland, Oregon. And apparently I was one of the two or three Oregonians not asked to be on the Governor's Vision Committee, which is probably a good thing, given how much work was involved listening to the previous witnesses, but also because I don't have a vested interest in this bill because I never was involved in the drafting of it. so I can give you a critical appraisal of it, which I will. I'm going to depart from the kumbaya singing that's been going on about it and talk a little more about some of the things that are wrong with it. I should also let you know, for the last 6 or 7 years, I've served on the Oregon Road User Fee Task Force, which you created a couple of sessions back. And we did essentially the same thing anyway, which is to look at about 35 different ways you could fund roads, trying to figure out, well, what is a road user fee and how would it be implemented? So I've been down this path quite a bit before. And that's just kind of a quick background for set of context for this bill. It concerns me that probably most people didn't realize when I-205 opened in 1982, essentially, we were done with highway building in Oregon. I didn't think that at the time, but you look back now, well, what have we done since then? Starting certainly with Governor Goldschmidt and picking up momentum in every other governor since then, the big capital projects have all shifted to some form of rail transit, billions and billions of dollars serving small numbers of people going a tiny number of places and letting the road system essentially deteriorate on the notion that somehow the interstate highway system was maybe some kind of historical accident, and we got to get that out of our system and move on to sort of downsizing the roads and encouraging lots of congestion, which is what we do in Portland. You know, in terms of the amount of money we spend as of our personal state income on highway building, it has plummeted in the last 40 years. It's interesting to me that ODOT has shown over a 50-year period there's a very strong correlation between adding jobs and adding vehicle miles traveled. For every new job you add, you can expect about 15,500 miles driven, and for every rise in personal income of $1,000, you can expect an additional VMT of 360 miles per year because there's a strong link between rising affluence and demand for driving. Now, we may wish that for every job that was added, there would be less vehicle miles traveled, but that's not reality. So if you're in favor of adding jobs to the state, if you're in favor of rising income, and if you're in favor of reduced congestion, then you have to have a highway building strategy. There is none in this state, and there is none in this bill. That's part of the problem with it. Specifically, I'm not going to go through all of them. I've listed on my testimony. There's too much emphasis on taxing ownership rather than vehicle use. Essentially, every way that the drafters of this could stick another tax on, they did. My concern is what you need. The message you need to send to people is you recognize that many people have more than one vehicle. Most people only drive one at a time, and that vehicle that's sitting around may be used just occasionally. And when you try and tax something that doesn't go anywhere, you're mixing up the message that it's the use of the vehicle that imposes some social external cost in society. Sitting in your driveway, there's no cost imposed. And so we should, as part of the give to get of politics, we should try and lower fixed taxes and fees to motorists, but raise the marginal cost, the variable cost, because that's where the rub is. Okay, the bill is excessively bureaucratic, gets into all kinds of things like least cost planning, one of these failed ideas out of the utility regulatory sector. And besides, we've been doing least cost planning in transportation for at least the 38 years that the EISs have been involved. And if you look at the way there's done in Metro, every time they have a big project, they look in the EIS at all these different alternatives. They tend to pick the most expensive alternative. So, you know, that whole thing is a waste. There's little concern in the bill for congestion relief. It's hardly ever mentioned. By raising the payroll tax for transit districts, then you simply enable this dysfunctional behavior, especially of Portland transit planners who continue to send TriMet on what I view as a financial suicide mission of just building trains that cost them a huge amount of money to operate over time. And the plan doesn't acknowledge the road wear problems associated with studded tires. It's interesting to me that you went through about 20 witnesses of people who were all part of the insider group. There was only a previous witness who was one of your first public witnesses today who talked about the studded tire problem. And there's only really two real sources of road wear, studded tires and heavy trucks already pay weight mile tax. So my view is you need a set of principles to get through this problem. I laid out some, in particular, that users need to pay. They need to pay at the margin, and the margin means based on time of day, day of week, direction of travel, because providing someone the road capacity they want at 2 in the morning is really cheap compared to the road capacity a lot of people want at 6:30 in the morning. And the reason the gas tax can never serve as a way of reducing congestion is because the gas tax is fixed. If we all pay it at 11 o'clock at night and at 6:30 in the morning, we all perceive road highway access to be, quote, free. Well, it's not free. And we all rush in into a vacuum there, and we end up degrading the travel experience for all of us because there's too much demand relative to supply. And the I have a number of things here in the bill that I think should move forward. I guess the heart of my testimony is to say that this is a Christmas tree bill. A lot of bad ideas are thrown in the hope that they'll stick. I think they should be cut out and examined under the light of a separate bill. But that I think, although I support the governor's reference to congestion pricing and I support a VMT fee, I don't think it's necessary to do the whole statewide thing with the GPS that the previous witness was mentioning, although I was part of that came up with that. I think the way to get there is to take the state highway system, which is only about 13% of the highways in the state, or roadway, but has 60% of the VMT, convert that to an electronic tollway, a turnpike, completely self-financing with variable tolls in Portland, and then let all the other roads be financed through a combination of gas taxes, property taxes, system development charges, parking fees in places like Portland. And that way, for most miles driven from the high-speed highways, you could give people what they want, which is the ability to go really fast, finance those roads, and finance the next generation of expansion. And I think with that, I will stop. I just note on the back a couple pages here that, politically speaking, what I offer gives taxpayers and motorists lots of things they want, which then makes them more comfortable moving on things like variable tolling.
Thank
Happy
you.
To answer any questions.
And all right. Neil, if you want to go ahead, and then if there are questions, we'll...
Yes. Excuse me. Chairman Beyer and committee, thank you for listening. My name is Neil Feldman. I'm a citizen of Salem. I'm also chair of the Special Transportation Committee, Special Transportation Fund for Salem Transit. So needless to say, in being in the chair and all that, I do support mass transit. I support it greatly. As I've said many times, I'm in direct opposition to the cult of the automobile. I've actually gone, you know, they go with the mixed-use thing, and, okay, there's a store right, you know, about a block away. I've actually literally seen people get in their car, start it up, drive out of the driveway, go down half a block, and pull in the driveway and get out. And so I'm not really sure if those people are really going to change their habits or whatever with mixed use, but I do agree that mixed use is the need to go. I wanted to mainly focus on, I believe I was told it was Section 56 of the bill, which basically would allow, just in the interest of speed, it's the part supposedly that allows the local transit districts to do like a payroll tax or some other kind of other than the property taxes, as I believe it's Representative Call.
Yes.
Brought up the transit cuts in Salem. The property owners are not happy with having to fund it. They reject it over and over again, which has caused funding, you know, to stagnate and expenses to go up. The paratransit, for example, which is an unfunded federal mandate, which I'd love to get. I've talked to Wyden about getting that funded because that's like the transit district had a $3.5 million shortfall and a $4 million annual cost for the paratransit. So do the math. they wouldn't have had a problem if it wasn't for the unfunded mandate. But they definitely need the ability to institute like a payroll tax or something like that. It still has the option. You know, people, you know, the paper had a editorial comment about it. Oh, they're doing an end run and they're trying to sneak by, and nobody's sneaking anything by. And if people want to put it on, you know, if the transit district puts a tax in there and the people want to put it on the ballot, they can put it on the ballot.
but it doesn't have to go on there to begin with. I also wanted to speak, I don't know what the sections are, but people had mentioned the Connect Oregon and the Betsy. Some of the funds from that go to the Specialized Transportation Fund, which funds a lot of rural and, you know, senior and disabled mass transit, which is anything that increases that. We just had our funding deal for that. We had requests for grants of approximately 5 times the amount of funds that we had to be able to allocate. So it was a really hard decisions to make to, you know, what to fund and what not to fund. We wanted to fund them all, but the money wasn't there in these flush financial days that we find ourselves in. And then the last point was to add my voice to the growing chorus of, anti-studded tires. Basically, I just personally feel that it would be illogical because I know ODOT's done studies. They know to the penny exactly how many dollars a year studded tires cost. And they know how many studded tires are installed on cars. Divide one by the other, and that's the tax per year per tire, and be done with it. And then they're paying their thing. And you don't have to have a whole bunch of calculus. I mean, it's just basic third grade math. But just wanted to leave it at that. But basically, I just really hope that Section 56 especially remains in, doesn't get pulled out. I realize, as the gentleman before me said, this is something of an omnibus Christmas bill. And I just want to make sure that part stays super glued to the branch. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Bailey?
Quick question. Ms. Meyer, you don't have known. Do you own a cell phone?
You know where this is going.
Chair Beyer, Representative Bailey, I knowingly choose to own a cell phone. Yes.
Thank you.
Nice try.
Yeah.
And if that works.
I do, having been one of the legislators that actually led one of the groups on studded tire usage, one of many of those, it isn't quite as simple to figure out the usage. There are estimates to how much damage they do on the roads, although the studded tire manufacturers would agree there's damage, they wouldn't agree with the amount that ODOT estimates it would be. And any time you try to figure out what the actual sales numbers are, this gets very proprietorial, and they don't disclose that information, so ODOT does not have that information. So it is, I mean, it certainly is something that kind of divides the state, but at some point, we keep hoping that new technology will get rid of the need.
People going by this morning with studded tires on. Like, yeah, we needed studded tires this morning.
Well, they are predicting rain again. I mean, snow again this weekend, I think. So, thank you, and we really appreciate your coming today. So.
Thank you.
Pat Iverson, Ramona Baker, and Alan Pollock. And people, we're trying to move as quickly as we can. I have the sign up sheets, and I don't know if everybody that was here had gotten signed up. So if you want to go ahead while they're getting situated, that'll keep us moving.
Hi, my name is Kat Iverson. I live in Washington County. I'm here to speak about an aspect of the bill which I think nobody has addressed yet. The medium-speed vehicles. This bill establishes, legalizes medium-speed vehicles on public roads. Let's see, I don't know what to say to be concise and avoid taking up too much time. There was a time when all vehicles were classified as motor vehicle or non-motor vehicle. And there were motor vehicles had to be licensed and registered. The drivers needed licenses. Non-motor vehicles had no restrictions. And there have developed a lot of requirements for motor vehicles. And recently there have been a lot of odd sorts of motor vehicles, you know, invented, manufactured, that don't meet all the requirements for the standard automobile. And so there have been exceptions written into the law to allow these to be, you know, used on streets. There are special exceptions to allow mopeds. There's now, let's see, golf carts can be used in certain conditions. Electric assisted bicycles, and there are low speed vehicles, and now you want to establish a medium speed vehicle that can go up to 35 miles an hour. I have no objection to that, but you want to limit its use to streets with speed limits of 40 miles an hour or less. And actually, next week, you'll be hearing House Bill 2542, which doesn't have all the taxes and things in this bill, but is strictly related to medium-speed vehicles. And it's the same, except that it bans them from speeds greater than 45 miles an hour. Either way, I don't think the ban is justified. There are now the speed limit is the maximum allowable speed. Nobody is required to go that fast. There are vehicles on the road which can't go the speed limit, and they're allowed. Farmers can drive their tractors at 20 miles an hour, even on roads where the speed limit is 50, 55, as it actually typically is in rural areas where all the farms are. A person can drive a bicycle and is unlikely to achieve, you know, 50 miles an hour, with the possible exception of down a steep hill. There are no restrictions to the roads bicycles can be ridden on. Let's see. Did I have a particular example? A low-speed vehicle, is the top allowable speed is 25 miles per hour. A motor-assisted scooter's top allowable speed is only 24. And as far as I've been able to discover, motor-assisted scooters can be used on any road. Low-speed vehicles are limited to roads with a speed limit of 35 miles an hour or less. And I see no logic to that. A person should be able to reach, you know, any destination by any vehicle that's legal on roads. I can understand if you want to ban them from freeways, since there are no destinations accessible to freeways. There are no, you know, houses or business driveways, but there are plenty of you know, houses and businesses on roads with high speed limits, and these vehicles would be totally useless. A farmer could hop on his tractor and drive, you know, to the neighbor or the nearest equivalent of a corner grocery store, but he wouldn't be able to use one of these medium speed vehicles.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and committee members. For the record, my name is Ramona Baker. I'm with Environment Oregon. I'm our Global Warming and Energy Policy Associate. And Environment Oregon is a citizen-based environmental advocacy organization representing 30,000 members across the state. Today, we're here to testify in support of HB 2120. First, I'll briefly discuss some of the problems with our current transportation system, then discuss the solution, and then emphasize some specific attributes of the bill. So the current problem with Oregon's 20th century transportation network is that it harms our environment and still costs families substantial amounts of money. Oregon's current transportation network contributes 40% of our global warming pollution. Auto dependency costs the average family more than $8,000 more than a public transit lifestyle. and the lack of adequate transportation options for the majority of Oregonians means that they can't make the shift towards less expensive, more convenient transportation that connects them with their communities. So the solution is to shift the balance of our transportation network toward public transit, bikes, and pedestrians. That will reduce projected vehicle miles traveled and put more money in the back pockets of average families. Additionally, as has been mentioned, we have the opportunity to put more Oregonians back to work. As we know, the construction of public transit creates 30% more jobs than the creation of new highways. HB 2120 puts us on the right path toward balancing our transportation network. For us, there are two primary components for shifting that balance: funding and planning. To improve immediate funding for public transit, biking, and pedestrians, the bill lifts the cap on transit district payroll tax, requires all federal flex funds for non-highway expenditures, authorizes Connect Oregon 3 for multimodal funding, improves resources for Amtrak service, and increases the bike set aside. But most importantly, HB 2120 must include the planning elements for reducing global warming pollution. This vital provision will require the six largest metropolitan planning organizations, or MPOs, to reduce global warming pollution through their land use and transportation plans. These reductions will be equal to the goals that have already been set by the state legislature. Again, transportation contributes 40% of our global warming pollution. So if Oregon is going to have a chance at actually meeting all of its goals of reducing that pollution by 80% by 2050, we must act now, and this planning element must be included in the final version of the bill. If we pass this bill and balance our transportation network, we'll make great strides in reducing global warming pollution, saving average households money, creating new jobs, and building stronger communities. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I also want to note that Brock Howell, our transportation advocate, was not able to be here today, but I have submitted his written testimony. He'd be happy to help and as the bill develops in any sort of work group or whatever the process may be.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. I'm Alan Pollack. I'm the general manager for Salem-Keizer Transit. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony to you on House Bill 2120, which originated as the Governor's Jobs and Transportation Act. In my testimony on February 25th, I provided you an overview of Salem-Keizer Transit to include our current funding situation and 27% reduction in service since 2006, and you heard a little bit about that impact with earlier testimony. Today I'm going to focus on House Bill 2120 with emphasis on some sections that are important to Salem-Keizer Transit. I would like to add that Salem Area Mass Transit's Board of Directors has endorsed House Bill 2120 as a comprehensive solution to improve Oregon's transportation system. The sections that are important to Salem-Keizer Transit include Section 15, the flexible federal funds for non-highway purposes, which you've heard about earlier this afternoon, Section 22 and 23, which are the Oregon 3 language. I would note that Salem-Keizer Transit was a recipient of a grant in Connect Oregon 2, which is allowing us to build a transit center in the northern half of our district. We also submitted an application for a transit center in our south half of our district. While being a competitive grant, it was the third or fourth project under the cut line, and we anticipate submitting another application in Connect Oregon 3 for that. The remainders of the sections all involve the local resources for mass transit and transportation districts, specifically Section 41, which increases the upper threshold of the payroll tax levy from 0.7% to 0.8%. Section 43 and 44, which for transportation districts allows a levy without prior approval and can be done by their board of directors. And then specifically Section 56, which addresses Salem Area Mass Transit District. Section 56 would repeal ORS Section 267.302, which right now requires our board to first seek voter approval of any measure that levies a business license fee, a payroll tax, or an income tax. I would like to note, though, if Section 56 remains a part of the package, it's not our intention to just go out and start implementing a payroll tax. We are working with our business community, and we would intend to continue working with them, not only on what would be an appropriate level, but what should that service be invested in so that our transit service is helping the business community. And any payroll tax that would be implemented would be a supplement to our existing primary local funding, which for us is the property tax. It is not our desire to replace one form of revenue with another. We would use the payroll tax to help supplement, and that would then allow us not to implement a tax, which right now Lane and TriMet do at significantly higher levels than we would need to. Probably a third of that, just based on some quick analysis, would allow us to restore the level of service that we have cut over the last couple of years. We are preparing a redesign of our existing service, which will roll out in September, which focuses on major corridors and arterials, and we'll create a base infrastructure of transit service in the community so that as we reach out and work with our business partners to increase the levels of service, they can see where that investment and work with us so that their investment helps not only the business community but the community as a whole. And we do believe right now, and under our current funding model, our federal and state partners are investing in us. Our local partners, our property tax on our property owners are investing in us, and our riders are investing in us by paying the fare. It is an important constituency out there who benefits from our service, which is the business community, and I believe if they're investing with us and working with us to improve that service, we'll be able to improve our service throughout the entire community. So I would just close in letting you know it is critical for the district to obtain a new additional sustainable funding source. House Bill 2120 does that for us. I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions before? No.
Thank you.
We have about seven more people, so if we stick to the 3 minutes, we should be good. And I have Ronnie Daniels, Sue Marshall, and Marianne Fitzgerald. So you're there. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairman of the Board, Vice Chairmen, and all the other representatives. My name is Ronnie Daniels. I'm a flagger, blue-collar man, that lives on a beer man's budget. I noticed in the last three sessions that we have raised allegedly $2.1 billion when they doubled the registration fees from $27 every 2 years to $54 every 2 years. And in the process, they was talking about bridges that they was placed. And I've liked some of the projects that we've done, like the situation that was approved by federal funding also to make add a third lane through Salem to this side of Jefferson, which is great, and there's other good projects. I feel ashamed that you, for a capital city, one of a few capital cities that does not take care of within on the transportational needs and this and another. I respectfully request that to meet their transportation needs when they should have a 6 to 7 day service for a capital city. It seems like the notion of this country is Portland is our capital of this great state of Oregon. This is Salem. And I think that, and I've fought against Mr. Swaim on various things when he was mayor, and I feel that y'all forget that's not me.
Somebody has a phone.
My phone is off. Okay. To make a point, a capital city like this, Sacramento, Boise, Helena, and various other communities throughout the West, even Phoenix, their capital cities are funded directly out of it, especially for transportational purposes, right out of their general budget. Less than 1/100% of the all funds budget. I don't see why this state can't do that. Second issue, pertaining to the registration fees, I have two 1983 vehicles. And as a flagger, I might be here, normally try to carpool, or sometimes I'm going to have to go off to the rural communities to help out the utilities when we have these nice little power outages and everything else. So that means I got to have a place to stay. I have a camper on my truck. My truck is a diesel-run vehicle. Gets about 20 miles to a gallon. Being it's geared low, I don't speed in it. And I do burn biodiesel. And I also, on top, try to run the best technology you can for an older vehicle of nature, which is 25-plus years old. The camper is only, it's a 71, nothing you need. I disagree with you on these doubling and tripling of some of these fees on older vehicles like this. I mean, I can go to Idaho for my truck for 2 years at $51 for 2 years. But at that point, also, that's different. That's a smaller state, but realistically, or even Arizona, same thing. I feel that some of these trees, by going from $27 a year to $81 a year in a recessive economy, that we're not sure of, that we're even going to make out, projected at the end of the fourth quarter this year. We're going on the pretense that's going to happen, but reality, we don't know. I do not have the means to absorb these extra costs. We have disconnected ourselves three times from the state, from the federal tax system, to keep our budget, quote-unquote, balanced. In terms, for example, last year, when I got back $428...
We're at the 3 minutes.
I know.
Need to wrap it up.
I'm going to make my point right now. The last person was 4.2 minutes. Okay?
I'm giving you time. I'm just saying,
okay,
wrap it up.
I'm going to wrap it up. Main point is this, ma'am, is that when you have a state disconnect, and I'm a single taxpayer, I do not have up to $10,000 to absorb the write-offs on a net income of $21,000. I feel that it's a tax increase when I have to pay not just on to help sustain economic sustainability stimulus package, the money was supposed to be coming from federal, when I had to go put it back in the general fund. That's not stimulating. That's taken out of my pocket. And I think that you need to, I would agree with a 4 to 6 cents gas tax, but I disagree at this economic times to tripling the registration fees. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And your comments are well noted. Go ahead.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing the Coalition for a Livable Future. The Coalition for a Livable Future is an association of 90 organizations of diverse interests and experience and hundreds of individuals. We come together. Our shared goal is to promote healthy and sustainable communities in the greater Portland metropolitan area. I'd like to just touch on two issues of interest to the coalition: transportation equity and funding for the Columbia River crossing. We want to stress the importance of equity in the transportation system and hope that as you deliberate on these issues, that that will be a lens that you look at both the policies and funding. Equity, in our mind, would be that everyone has, whatever their income, ability, cultural background, has access to a transportation system that enables them to have the mobility to get to places that not only they need to get to, but that they want to get to. We think an important component of equity in fostering equity in a transportation system is providing choices. Neighborhoods that are walkable, safe sidewalks, trails, pathways, bicycle lanes are all important components of a transportation infrastructure, all of which are much needed to be funded more adequately. Having these choices, we know, lowers the cost to individuals. It also promotes a healthy lifestyle for individuals, and we all benefit from the improved air quality. Also related to an equitable transportation system, and as funding is available, we would like to encourage you to look to increasing the diversity of the workforce, strengthening job opportunities for locally owned minority and women-owned businesses. We know there's other bills that will be before you related to these issues, and we support those. We are concerned about funding that's identified for the Columbia River crossing, $15 million per year, $30 million for the biennium. The project, in our mind, is too big, too costly at a time when we can really ill afford it, and has not considered our goals in meeting climate change and CO2 emissions. We believe those funds would be better suited to some of these alternative choices for people. The cost beyond the planning dollars that are identified, the total project is over $4 billion. The shared local cost between Washington and Oregon is $1.2 billion. And again, when we're looking ahead to a deficit of $3 billion, we don't think we can afford that, and there's better uses for those dollars. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very good. Right on time. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Marianne Fitzgerald. I'm a citizen in Southwest Portland, and I strongly support the Governor's Jobs and Transportation Act and urge you to consider the many benefits that this bill will bring to our state and to our communities. Oregon needs a multimodal system that will allow people, goods, and services to get where they need to go in a safe and efficient way. The current state gas tax and patchwork of local taxes and fees are not sufficient to meet our growing population needs. Too often, we prioritize limited funding on the major corridors and neglect the needs of the citizens in our neighborhoods. Oregon especially needs to invest in bicycle and pedestrian pathways and transit service and support alternative modes of travel. The neighborhood that I live in was built in the 60s in a suburban auto-dependent style, three-quarters of a mile to the nearest transit service and over a mile to the nearest grocery store, and there are no sidewalks or bike paths to get to either destination. I do chair the Southwest Coalition Transportation Committee, which consists of 17 neighborhood associations, and have been working very, very hard with the City of Portland to fund safer sidewalks and bike paths and improve transit service and make better land use and development decisions, but we've had limited success due to limited funds, and it's very expensive to retrofit neighborhoods like this. I do urge you to direct as much funding as possible to alternative modes, which would reduce the amount of vehicle miles traveled, reduce congestion on existing roads, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Some sections that would particularly benefit our communities include Section 15 that would direct the flexible funding to projects that enhance and expand transit, bikes, and walkways. Section 16 that requires ODOT and local government highway projects funded by ODOT to incorporate environmental performance standards into highway design and construction. I did work on this before I retired, and I know that there are provisions in there that limit air emissions by requiring cleaner fuels and limit idling that would reduce air toxics and noise in our neighborhoods. And also Section 45 that increases the amount of set aside for bicycles and pedestrians to 1.5% of the funds received from the Highway Fund. I do support a gas tax to increase to pay for the highway improvements, and I believe it should be higher than the 2 cents. I also support other funding revenues, such as the shifts described above for flexible funds and 1.5% for bikes and peds, plus higher registration fees to support the alternative modes that can't benefit from the gas tax. I urge you to support a long-term vision of safe, efficient, and multimodal transportation system throughout Oregon that will build stronger communities, improve our health and safety, support jobs, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Thank you.
Thank you. Time left over. You can breathe now. any questions, committee?
Yes. Sorry, Sue. I wanted to comment and thank you for you're not alone, I think, in your concerns about the CRC. What I will say is that this is what the governor's done here is really a fantastic compromise package where we're going to have land use coupled with transportation planning and MPOs playing an important part in what transportation looks like in our state. We're going to have an increase in the payroll tax so we can have more transit, $44 million in flexible funds going towards transit and multimodal funding in our state. And I think having all of those things in the balance is going to make a lot of us up here who are skeptical of the CRC willing to reach a compromise on that point. So I just hope that you and your contacts with all of your people that I know as well understand that there is a complex balance being struck here, and I think we're going to get a good deal. So mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We really appreciate your coming. Ralph Groner, Lisa Adato, and Mel Rader. And if we keep on track like this, we'll be okay. But I know we have a committee coming in after us today, so we'll get kicked out of here regardless if you're done. And I can cut you off anytime I want.
No, I know.
And some of us hope she
will.
You
haven't.
Please go ahead, Ralph.
I'll go ahead and do mine fast. For the record, Ralph Groner would ask me, and since everybody represents so many people, quite frankly, I represent 190 locals, and they're each of your cities and your counties as I look at all of you. I have your counties and your cities and metro. Those are our employees. And also the road crews at the city-county level. That's not our interest. I won't take 3 minutes. Joe Basler will be back on the intricacies. I've worked transportation, as you know, for what, the last 40 years, and been involved in some wins and some losses. It's been very frustrating to me. I work over 20 budgets in this building, and I quite frankly have to worry more about not the intricacies of the bill. I appreciate so much the work you've all done, primarily because it means jobs, jobs, jobs. I know I sound like a union person, and quite frankly, I'm proud of the fact I am, but I heard Bob Shiprock testify the other day, I can't even remember the committee, I've been in so many committees, that he had up to 30% unemployment in some of his locals, and I went, oh my God. So this is wonderful in that this will provide thousands of jobs in Oregon, family wage jobs. I know you get sick of that, but you know, it isn't just Bob. The very people that everyone here testified to they want to plan the environment are my members, from DLCD, my local, to Metro, my local, to Springfield, my local, to Klamath Falls. I can go right down the list. City of Eugene, City of Salem. The planners that work on these issues, both transportation and land use, are in fact AFSCME members. So our environmental caucus, which we have, endorses this measure, and our DEQ and our DLCD, our various locals, endorse this. I certainly, on behalf of AFSCME, support it, but it also impacts my other budgets that I work on, seniors, disabled, children, universities, public safety, DLCD, Department of Land Conservation Development, DEQ, OHSU, public health, mental health, and my list goes on. I was charged by my boss to raise $2 billion new dollars, so I don't see you very often because he moved me off all of these other issues temporarily so that I could work on helping raise new money to put into the general fund. You're a big part of it, the jobs, and the other is energy efficiencies. There Representative Bailey, Representative Call, and a good number of you are working on. There are bills in that also will provide significant amount of jobs. So we thank you, and I just want you to know the money created by these people working does the very things that environmental community and others want to happen.
Thank you.
Pays for their budgets. Thank you.
Right on time. Lisa.
Thank you, Chairman Beyer and committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. And my name is Lisa Adato, and I am the Oregon director of a group called Climate Solutions. And we represent... Our mission is to find profitable and sensible and realistic ways to deal with the climate issue that sort of aligns business issues and the environmental issues. So this is a really good bill for us. And prior to that, I worked with the Oregon Business Association as the environmental director. So I've had a chance to talk to hundreds and hundreds of businesses about the issues of that are sort of in the nexus between climate and business. And I'd like to, one of my first comments is that this is a very critical bill. And the reason is that it has pulled together, as people have said, the environmental community and the business community. And there's been a history of killing off transportation bills if they don't meet environmental needs, or a history of problems when those two groups don't get together. So one of the smart things that the governor did, and I was part of that process too, is bring the groups together to come up with a bill that really meets the multiple needs of the business community, which wants to reduce costs and move goods and services through the community, and the environmental needs of reducing climate pollution and other things. So I think this particular bill is a very critical bill. I won't repeat some of the things that people have said already, but I do want to make a couple of other points. One is that In other parts of the building, there's debates going on about capping global warming pollution, and that is something that is going to be necessary. And one of the goals in a really shorter-term framework is that we need to reduce our global warming pollution to 10% below 1990 levels, and we're going the wrong direction. So that's probably from today reducing global warming pollution by about 15%. So when you think about that, you heard about from Bob Russell and others, our population is growing. How in the heck are we going to do that? And a little bit of context, there's really four ways to reduce global warming pollution in the transportation sector, and we're going to need to do all of them. We can't meet that goal by just doing one of those things. One is we're going to need to use more efficient vehicles with better gas mileage. And we have a tailpipe emission standard that focuses on that issue. One is that we're going to need to use lower carbon fuels, such as electricity and low carbon biofuels. And we've got a separate bill, House Bill 2186, that deals with that. The third thing that we're going to need to do is shift some transportation needs to lower carbon-intensive modes like barges and trains. And finally, we're going to have to reduce the amount of traveling we do so we reduce our vehicle miles traveled. So all four of those things are critical. We've got some other bills, but that's the context. The pieces of this bill are really critical. Another thing that Bob Russell talked about is doubling our freight load. And one of the things I'd like to urge this committee to do is really think about not just this time, but in the future, that we really do need to focus on trains. And we did quite a bit of work on trains when I was with the OBA, and we have huge infrastructure here in Oregon that is not well used that's related to trains. We've got a lot of short lines that are sort of underutilized. So this bill allows us with bonding and flexible funds to start that focus, and we're simply not going to be able to meet our goals, even to move goods and services, unless we are able to move both passengers and freights on trains. So I urge you to make that a focus for transportation in Oregon. And we've heard a lot about bikes and walking and those things. They're important too. But that investment in other modes is going to be critical for our future in Oregon. So thank you very much for the time. And maybe I'm under the 3 minutes too.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, and I'm going to go ahead and ask Jonathan Schluter, our last person on the list, to come on up while we're... So,
great.
Go ahead.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mel Rader. I'm the project director for Upstream Public Health. And I'm here to tell you that the decisions you're making around this bill are not only critical to the stability of our climate and our state's economy, but they also have a profound impact on the health of Oregon residents. We face dual threats to the stability of our climate system as well as the health of Oregonians through our obesity epidemic. Experts are predicting that for the first time ever, the next generation of America's children may live shorter lives than their parents due to obesity. And I ask you whether we as a state and as a society should not take a step back and consider how transportation and land use policies impact our patterns of physical activity and our exposure to air pollutants that thereby profoundly impact our health. Many of you may not be aware that air pollution kills more people than car collisions, and land use policies that promote densely populated cities may be one of the most effective strategies to promote healthy weight. In a recent study, researchers found that sprawl and urban design among American cities could explain a difference of 6 pounds per person. So sprawl in our cities is really closely linked to sprawl in our waistlines. It is estimated that each pound overweight results in $19 in healthcare costs. So if each Oregonian loses 6 pounds, then we save $430 million in healthcare costs each year. And many people would live longer and healthier lives. Upstream Public Health has commissioned a study from OHSU to better understand and assess how policy strategies to reduce vehicle miles traveled in Oregon impact health. And the study will be released in early May to inform policy discussion in the legislature and implementation strategies at the local level. But even before the study is completed, it's clear that the solutions to reduce global warming are the same solutions in general to promote more physically active populations. That is why I'm urging you to invest in a new vision for a transportation system, one that provides real alternatives to driving by reducing vehicle miles traveled. I urge you to allocate all of the federal flexible funds to non-highway projects. They increase the investments in walking and biking facilities even more than the 50% increase that's being considered. And I also urge this committee to move toward a vision for Oregon that reduces sprawl in our cities to save resources and save lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. I promise I will not be the reason you're late in getting on to your next appointments. For the record, Westside Economic Alliance is a business advocacy group that represents the private sector employers, developers, commercial property managers, and the communities on the west side of the Portland metro region. The point that I wish to leave with you is simply this. Washington County, even in this economic climate, is the fastest growing county in the state of Oregon. We added 9,900 people to the population of Oregon last year. That's 27 more people in Washington County when Representative Edwards and I go home this evening than were there this morning. The population continues to grow, but in the same time, we lost 8,900 jobs in Washington County last year. Our unemployment rate is now 8.5%. That is disgraceful. Oregon has led the nation's unemployment rate for 150 consecutive months. That is shameful, and that is not an accident. We have to get back to work. Our organization is very pleased to stake the ground with House Bill 2120 as a high priority for this session. We urge its adoption, but don't stop there. The 2-cent gas tax increase as proposed in the bill is simply not adequate to the need. We want to see that increase 2 cents a year for each of the next 5 years, a 10-cent gas tax increase in total. Let's get serious about the funding needs of the state. It's expensive, sure, but not as expensive as it took me to drive down here today to offer this little bit of testimony. We have to invest in the future of this state. We have to invest in the jobs of this state. Washington County accounts for 16% of the personal income tax that you will collect as a state of Oregon from the payroll and the jobs in our county. It counts that we get to work in the morning and that our products get to the warehouse and distribution points in the afternoon. So our points are simply this. We need freight mobility. We need road capacity. We need commuter access. We need modal choice. We want system reliability, and we have to ensure public safety. The way to do that is to invest in our transportation system. You're well on the way to that mark. I applaud those efforts. I'll take up the other particulars at another time when we have more time, and thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you very much for coming. And I don't see any questions. And with that, thank everybody for their great testimony today, and as we'll start moving forward with this bill. And we're adjourned. Thank you.